The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on the show this week...
As far as we know, there is nothing there but the randomness. It's just probability. We can predict how likely something is, but not when it actually will happen.
To give some context to my random appearances on the podcast of late, only kidding, I met Brian Clegg to discuss his latest book, Dice World, Science and Life in a Random Universe. And...
You know, I've fought for this for 12 years, and I am just so happy.
News broke this week of a life-changing breakthrough into the cause and cure of what is called modic-related lower back pain, and the role of a relatively common bacterial infection. The scientist who battled for more than 12 years to find evidence and test a cure, Dr. Hannah Albert, will be telling us what led to this momentous medical discovery. Also, we'll be taking a look at some of this week's standout science stories, including new findings about water crystals on the moon and NASA's plans for Mars. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Brian Clegg is a science writer whose books include Gravity and A Brief History of Infinity. His latest book, Dice World, takes on the subject of randomness in our universe. Brian came into The Guardian studios to tell me more. Brian, welcome to the podcast. Can I start by just asking you to define for me, and this might be an odd thing for this program, given that our listeners will know a lot about randomness and chance and statistics and things, but what is randomness from a scientific point of view?
It's funny, it's that one of those things, it's a bit like talking about time or anything like that. It's a word we use all the time without really thinking what it is. And when you start looking at things that are random, it can be quite difficult to pin down. So, for instance, a random sequence of numbers could be 1, 2, 3. It could come up like that.
It doesn't sound random, but it is.
That's right. It's basically where, say it is a sequence of numbers, there's no relationship between the number and the what's come before. So it could be, say it's a random set of numbers between 1 and 10. It could be any one of those with equal probability. You don't know what's coming out next, and it's not influenced by the history, by the past.
I mean, and the interesting thing when you said 1, 2, 3 is, of course, that could be a random string of numbers. But immediately my brain thinks pattern. It's 1, 2, 3 is just the number line, right? And I'll then infer meanings and things onto it where there is none altogether. And that's how our brains work, of course. We look for patterns all over the place.
That's right. It's how we understand the world around us. And it's one of the reasons we have so much trouble with randomness. That when something truly is random, when something happens that has no real identifiable cause, we have to find something. We have to find an excuse, a culprit, some reason why it's happened.
Which is the basis of most evolutionary psychology, isn't it? Essentially, what is it? Tigers hiding in bushes, and according to our brains. Now, when is it that we worked out as a species that randomness was the thing that rules the universe rather than Newton's clockwork? Because, you know, Newton, one of the greatest scientists that ever lived, laws of motion, once he discovered those, we can predict everything, right? But not quite.
Well, certainly that's what, for instance, Laplace thought, sort of building on Newton's work. He actually said, you know, if you had the right being that had the right information, the right ability to calculate everything, then it should be able to predict everything that's ever going to happen in the universe. But actually, even back in Newton's time, they knew there were some things that were pretty difficult. So the classic example is the three-body problem. So if you have, say, the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, working out how they influence each other, Newton knew he couldn't do it, but he thought in principle it could be possible.
Just hard maths or something.
That's what they thought back then. But since then, it's been realised that it is just something that is never going to be known absolutely and to perfection. And then, obviously, once you get into the 20th century, you've got things like quantum theory starting to show that randomness is actually at the heart of everything.
So it's not just that things are very hard to work out. The fact is that, for example, in quantum mechanics, chance and probability are built into nature. There's no way of actually finding that. There's no solution that's definite.
That's right. And that's what, for instance, Einstein finds so difficult to deal with. You know, all the quotations for him that are approximately God doesn't throw dice, were along the lines, really, of thinking that there must be some sort of hidden variables lying underneath, something that would predict exactly what's going to happen, why a particular atom decays at a particular time. But actually, as far as we know, there is nothing there but the randomness. It's just probability. We can predict how likely something is, but not when it actually will happen.
So we've had a century of special relativity, general relativity, quantum mechanics, these great changes to the intuitive way that we've thought that nature worked until, you know, the end of the 19th century. But we've done really well with science in that year, in that century. It's been incredibly successful and built this entire world around us. How do scientists deal with this then? Because randomness might seem debilitating in some respect, but it's still predictable.
That's right. I mean, in some ways, there are two levels of this. The basic approach in everyday life is you ignore the fact we don't know things exactly, and you get around it, you know, by approximation. So if you want to send a rocket to the moon, even though technically we don't know exactly where the moon is to the nearest tiny amount, in practice, we know where it's going to be. We can predict it well enough to send a rocket there. So approximation takes you to one stage. The other thing is that whereas really random things, we can't say anything about a specific object. So, for instance, when a particular atom will decay, what we can do is take an overall picture. Statistics enables us to give a good understanding of what's happening across a group of things that are operating randomly.
And so that's been the sort of progress of physics, of biology, all these subjects, medical evidence-based medicine is based a lot around these sorts of things. And we get into the world of statistics, which probably is a fearful thing for most people from their maths classes. But in statistics, you've got words like significance and variation, which tell you how wrong or right you are. And in a sense, a lot of science is about categorizing how what your ignorance levels are of a certain thing. So take us through what some of this means. How have those sorts of disciplines like probability and statistics developed to sort of take into account these sorts of things? And these things give us lots of power in understanding this random world of ours.
Yeah, I mean, statistics really dates back to roughly the 17th century that people started thinking about how do we deal with large sets of numbers. The stat in statistics is the same origin as the word state. It's basically was originally statistics were information about a state, about a country. And we started off with people, somebody called Graunt, who was actually a button maker, but in his spare time went into starting to understand a little bit about the statistics of how people live and die. It's really the origins of the insurance business that came out of the London coffee houses. So people were starting to think about how numbers work that way relatively early on. But later on, when we started thinking about, for instance, how a gas works, understanding a gas, where there are just billions and billions of atoms, there's no way of tracking each one individually. Statistical approaches gave us a much better understanding of what was going on, and it's become really central to an awful lot of physics. So you've got it in thermodynamics, explaining how heat and engines work, all the way through to quantum theories we've already mentioned.
And quantum theory is basically a science, it's essentially based on probabilities. There are no absolutes in there at all. I mean, it's, every answer you get is a probability of one thing or a probability of another, and then over many, many examples of the same thing, you get these patterns. Do you think that we talked about how human brains deal with randomness and how we like to find patterns. Is this why we're so bad at working out what the risk of something is, relative risks, all of these things? People moan all the time about how humans, we over-dramatize some things and under-dramatize other things.
Yeah, I mean, the two things happening really. One is that probability itself we struggle with because, as we've said already, patterns are so essential to us. So if you've got something that is happening totally randomly, it will tend to come in little clusters and gaps. If you think about, say, dropping a tin full of ball bearings on the floor, it would be really weird if they were all spread out evenly. You'd expect them to come in little clumps and clusters. But when, say, deaths happen in a cluster, you immediately start thinking there must be a cause, there must be something behind it. And traditionally it would be a witch you would blame, or a curse put on somebody locally. These days it's more likely to be phone masts or nuclear power stations or whatever, not pubs or churches, interestingly, which also tend to occur where there are clusters, but there you go. One aspect of that is getting on top of these patterns and clusters. And I think the other thing with risk is we tend to be very influenced by something that's immediate. So when we just heard about something, when it's in the news, our mental awareness of risk goes up very strongly. So, for instance, if somebody's been arrested for, abducting people in taxis, people are immediately wary of going in taxis, even though actually the risk has just gone down because the person has just been arrested who may well have been causing the offence. So our attitude to risk is hugely influenced by what's in the news, what's in the media, what hits us up front.
How do we use some of the ideas in your book then to live a more risk, I wouldn't say risk averse, but a sensibly risked life?
I think it's partly is just getting a little bit of a better understanding of numbers and statistics. It's very easy to mislead with numbers. And frankly, the media can sometimes be rather bad at this. So, you know, particularly when, say, percentages are used, it's worth just taking a step back and saying, what are the numbers behind those? So, you know, if violent crime has gone up by 100%, it sounds disastrous. But if it was only one to start with, it's only two now. So you need to know a bit more, know the numbers
absolute
a bit more.
Absolute numbers rather than relative numbers.
Yeah, I mean, that can help a lot. But the other thing is to try to put things into perspective, you know, to say if it is a plane crash or, a bombing as we've recently experienced, to put it into context, not to suddenly panic and think, you know, every time I go out, I'm going to be subjected to more risk now, because that's not just not how it is.
There are some bits of the nature that are random and almost in their own way, bizarrely unpredictable. You've got a small chapter on chaos theory. Mm-hmm. How does that fit into the idea of randomness? Because that's a different type of random. It's a very weird thing.
That's right. In a way, chaos isn't random. Chaos is basically where a system is so delicately balanced that a very tiny difference in the way it starts off can result in a different outcome.
I think whoever named it chaos deserves some credit in the way that we now think of it as completely crazy. But go on. Yeah.
So, a great example is the weather. You know, something we all like to talk about. Weather is chaotic. It's where the origins of chaos theory came from. A guy called Lorentz was studying weather patterns using a very early computer program. And he'd run it part of the way. He'd got a printout of the information from the program and wanted to run it again. So he put in the numbers from his printout as his starting position. And what he forgot was that it actually printed out only three decimal places, where it was actually working to six decimal places. And as a result of that, just that tiny change, the pattern actually changed dramatically over time. And it was this realization that a very small change in the starting position can have a huge influence in the outcome. Now, chaotic systems in principle, if we had all the information, if we could crunch all the numbers, are just like Laplace thought the world was like. We really could predict it perfectly.
So there's no limit there particularly that means that we can't do that?
In principle, yeah. But in practice, the fact is we can never get all that enough data to be able to sensibly predict. And so, for instance, we will never get good weather forecasts beyond 5 to 10 days, anything beyond there. In fact, if anything, just taking a guess based on the climate and what the climate is typically like typically comes out with a better result than trying to predict beyond 10 days.
I suppose also I've heard that in some chaotic systems that the size of the computer you would need to predict everything is the size of the system itself. And basically the system is the best way of predicting it. So in a sense, you get into this infinite loop where you can't actually build anything to simulate it or reduce it in that way. Tell us also about another way to sort of understand risk and probability and relationships between things that are random, rather. You talk in a chapter about Bayesian statistics, the Reverend Bayes. Now, he came up with something very useful.
Yeah, Bayesian statistics is one of those things that for a long time was considered a bit dubious, that some mathematicians wouldn't touch it with the barge pole. The reason being that it's a bit subjective. It doesn't rely 100% on absolute known stuff, which mathematicians get very wary of. It relies more on the things that we think are likely. And what it enables you to do, basically, is if you know, for instance, the chances of, I don't know, one thing happen if something else happens, it lets you do the inverse and say, what's the chances of the something else given the one? So, you know, if I know the chances of a meteor shower happening in as a result of a particular thing happening in the universe, I can turn it round and say, okay, what's the chances of the thing happening in the universe if I've witnessed a meteor shower? It sort of lets you invert what's happening. But what it typically relies on is you coming up with an approximation to the probability of something happening and plugging that in. And that's really why statisticians have always been a bit wary of it as an approach. But it is actually very powerful.
It's very powerful. But also, Bayesian idea, if you know something, then what's the probability of something else, is kind of how we think about things. It's a very natural way to do it. Even if we don't call it Bayesian in our own heads, we do that all the time. If that person walks into the room, what's the chance of this or whatever else? I mean, if that, then that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what it lets you do is you take a starting position and then improve on it, given extra information, which, as you say, is exactly how we interact with the world around us.
When you talk to people about the book and talk to them about things like chaos and randomness and everything, what's people's first reaction to knowing that the world they live in is not as predictable and happy and sort of ordered as they might have thought? Because we like to think that.
Yeah, there's
is it worrying?
Well, yes and no. I think it has an initial feeling of, oh dear, I'm a bit worried about this. I don't like the idea that it's based on randomness. But on the other hand, I suppose if you take the sort of Laplacian view and have a totally clockwork universe, then you certainly can throw away any concepts like free will, because in principle, everything is preordained. Everything will happen the way it is going to happen. So some people would actually say it's quite good that we have a degree of randomness in there, so at least we couldn't actually ever forecast everything in the future.
Well, the idea of free will is perhaps something for a different conversation, but I was going to ask you, where does it leave free will? Is this the physicist's attempts to leave us some free will at the end of it? Because otherwise, as you say, the clockwork universe implies some sort of a clockwork maker of some sort and so on.
I'm being
facetious, yeah. I think a little bit, but
yeah, I mean, it does give you an aspect of freedom in the sense that you can't predict what's going to happen. In the end, it's not free will in the sense that you can't control when atoms are going to do what they do. So in a sense, you don't have control over it, but at least what you can say is that everything isn't preordained, that it wasn't all set from day zero that you could predict what was going to happen in the future.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place to end. Brian, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Dice World, Science and Life in a Random Universe is published by Icon Books, and predictably and conveniently, it's out in all good on and offline bookshops. Let's look now at some of this week's science stories, and I'm glad to welcome Guardian Science correspondent Ian Sample back to the studio. Ian, welcome back.
Hello.
Ian, we've both been away for a few months. Let's ignore what's happened in that time and go back to what's happened this week. Now, you wrote a wonderful story about there being water on the moon, which I've heard before.
Yeah, it wasn't a story about there being water on the moon, but it was really trying to answer this question of where that water came from.
Okay.
Because decades ago, a lot of people probably thought of the moon as this sort of dry, you know, arid expanse hovering over our heads, so to speak. But a lot of missions since then have shown that it's that there's water, that you have a sort of a thin frost of ice over the surface, and there's water in the form of like water, you know, particles like hydroxyl ions and things like this, rather than
soil.
Flowing water in the soil and through the body of the moon. And one of the questions came then is, well, how did this water get there? Because the kind of leading theory of how the moon formed is that a planet the size of Mars thumped into Earth about 4.5 billion years ago and created this enormous hot cloud of debris from which the moon formed. And the temperatures you're talking about being involved in that would be so hot that you'd imagine any water that was on the Earth already would have just evaporated. So when the moon formed, where did this water come from? Because the water runs through it. So what this study does is the researchers went to some of the really most extraordinary material that was brought back from the moon by the Apollo missions. This would be the green rock brought back by Apollo 15 and some sort of orange material brought back by Apollo 17. And this green rock was this green-tinged rock was this subject of this amazing sort of debate on the moon between Dave Scott, the commander, and the lunar module pilot, Jim Owen, about, you go through the transcript of when they find this thing, it looks a bit green. Nah. It's not green. It can't be green. Looks a bit green. And they just debate it for ages because I think they're sort of reluctant to call back to NASA to say, we found some green rock.
But they just picked it up and brought it back.
In the end, they picked it up and brought it back anyway. And the analyses on these rocks, what they've been looking for are these tiny, and we're talking about 10, 20, 30 micron wide glass beads that are lodged inside this volcanic rock. And the beads are trapped inside crystals. Now, this kind of material has come up from inside the moon, ended up on the surface. So it gives you a kind of a snapshot of what the interior of the moon looked like. And you can do analyses on those glass beads, and you can see traces of water and hydrogen inside them. And you can try and work out where that came from. So what these guys did from Brown University in the US was they looked at the ratios of some isotopes in the water inside these glass beads, and you're looking at how much deuterium to hydrogen there is. And if you find a low ratio of deuterium, it means that this stuff probably formed nearer into the sun. If you have a very high ratio of deuterium to hydrogen, deuterium just being the sort of heavy isotope of hydrogen, it formed way out in the solar system, sort of comet territory. Basically, what they found is that the water from inside the moon matches that you find on these really ancient meteorites called carbonaceous chondrites, which are thought to be the ones that gave water to Earth, because
that was my next
the
question.
Ratios look the same.
So the leading theory of how water came to Earth is by meteorite bombardment, essentially.
That's
the,
right.
The late heavy bombardment about a billion years after the Earth formed.
Well, something like 98% of the water that Earth holds could have come from these meteorites. And they hold the same isotopic signature as the water on the Earth, the water in these on the Moon, and also these meteorites. So you're tying it together. Now, you can say, well, did these meteorites just bombard the Moon? Well, the idea is you're finding this water all the way through the Moon. So the idea is that it was there from the original material. So what? I mean, the upshot of all of this is really that the Earth was already damp, if you like, already had this water on it. And some of that water survived this huge impact that gave rise to the Moon. So when the Moon was forming out of the dust cloud from that impact, there was the water there. A lot of that must have been retained, because that is what you see in the Moon today when you look at the rocks.
And remains a potential source of water for the future moon base that NASA is no doubt going to build.
Well, yeah, if you're going to go through and do the chemical processes on it to pull out the hydrogen, the oxygen, recombine it and do all that, yeah.
Talking of moon bases, bases on other planets rather, NASA's chief Charlie Bolden made a speech last week at a conference where he reiterated NASA's intentions to go to Mars. Now, this suffered some sort of many setbacks since George Bush's initial challenge back in 2003 or 2004, I think, where he said that NASA should go to the moon by 2018 and Mars by 2030. And in the decades since then, there have been lots of setbacks in terms of, the shuttle's retired, they don't have a replacement yet, budget funding cuts. Barack Obama, despite his wonderful election for many other things, is not really interested in space. The economic crisis, all these things have happened to make NASA really question whether it can get to Mars ever. But Charlie Bolden, the administrator, is as keen as ever. He said that interest in sending humans to Mars has never been higher. And within the next few weeks, NASA is actually going to announce which 20 training astronauts it's going to choose from the almost 6,500 applications to its recent round. That's like the second highest ever. So interest in space is very high. These people want to go. And these particular training astronauts are going to be among the first trained for specifically for long-duration space flights. So NASA still has hopes there. The most recent problem it's had is that in February, NASA's budget specifically for Mars exploration was just slashed. And it's not really got the cash to start researching all of this stuff yet. We've got potentially private rocket contractors going to build the rockets that take all the stuff up there. So what Charlie Bolden said in his speech was, well, there are many technology gaps still. We've still got to work out how we deliver a payload to Mars. Curiosity landed last year in a spectacular fashion using something called a sky crane, which we've talked about before. But, that's a one-ton rover. Anything to do with humans is going to have to be many, many orders of magnitude heavier than that. Plus, also, there's going to have to be energy, much higher energy requirements. So what he's suggesting perhaps is that the NASA focuses most of its money on Mars and these sorts of technology problems and lets private companies, it just buys its services from private companies for things like rockets and so on, which makes a lot of sense, given that the private commercial space industry is boom. Well, I wouldn't say booming. It's pre-boom at the moment in America, isn't it? And there have been individual companies offering trips to Mars already. We get these periodic sort of upswells of support for Mars from NASA, despite all the problems. I mean, I think we're both quite keen to see people on Mars. What would you think? Do you think it'll happen?
Well, it's interesting because before this, the NASA aim had been sort of downscaled to appreciate that you have to get out of this endless circling around the Earth, which the ISS has been doing, which I think is, you know, is no mean feat, but is criticized and was criticized by Mike Griffin, you know, the previous NASA administrator. And so the next plan seemed to be, let's go to near Earth objects. So let's go and try and land someone on an asteroid going by, and which is fantastically interesting and bold
and difficult.
But so to now say, actually, I don't know if they've really abandoned that plan, but to then say, well,
the asteroid capture and return sample mission is still going to go ahead. And I think that the idea is that that will be a technology testbed for future Mars missions. Whether the asteroid capture mission is the best technology testbed for Mars, don't know. But I suppose they've got to do what they can do, right?
But it's interesting also is what the impact of some of these other projects that we've seen coming out of the private sector will have on the sort of the public program, if you like. I mean, you've got Dennis Tito, you've got these other ideas which aim to send people, if not to land on Mars, then to loop around it and come back. And certainly with Dennis Tito's, the project will... You know, if that project goes ahead, if he can get funding for it, which is a huge if, those people will come back in that capsule, whether they're alive or not, because of the slingshot orbit it will go on. Now, whether these things, how well those projects go, I wonder if that may have an impact actually on the sort of public support for a NASA.
I expect mission. A lot of this stuff will. I mean, Dennis Tito's plan is to send people on an orbit of Mars in 2018, but paying customers essentially. And so, you know, these guys will probably know all the risks. And if the thing with NASA is, of course, that now it's got to think about all the risks of everything to its astronauts. I mean, radiation, for example, is going to be extreme in the trip to Mars and on Mars itself. They've got to really think about that. They've got to think about, as I said, power, survival, and all those things. And it's a government agency, so it can't get away with not thinking about all the risks. Whereas private companies, they're not beholden to anyone apart from their shareholders and themselves. Mm. And so, you know, if people want to volunteer to go, it's not as long as it's not illegal, off they go. And I expect that they'll provide lots of very useful data as long as they're sort of plugged in to the whole thing. There's another organization called Mars One, has 10,000 applicants to join a four-person mission to the planet, to Mars in 2013. So, yeah, these guys... If they do it, I mean, it's like 10 years away, and all of this stuff. If they do it, they're going to get there before NASA. And we'll at least, there'll be enough interest in there, at least, won't there, for that long? Because you've got to keep kids. Kids now are the ones who are going to go to Mars via NASA by the time they're 30 or 40 or whatever. So you've got to keep them interested for that long.
And also, this will drive, I mean, bear in mind that a lot of the reason, the chief reason that the US was putting money into NASA for so long was because you're driving the aerospace industry, and the aerospace industry has been incredibly profitable for the US. And also, if you put people in an extreme environment, like in orbit, you're pushing an awful lot of different areas of science. So you're going to be having to be at the top of your game to be able to do that and to be able to develop technologies in that kind of area. So it's a really good way of stretching things and making sure people are doing smart stuff and facing big problems that they've got to overcome. The tricky one I haven't seen solved for the Mars trip is, what do you do about a coronal mass ejection if you get one of these huge pulses of radiation coming from the sun? Because it's not like just the background radiation that you would face. With the Apollo missions, they got lucky and that they were able to get to the moon and back without any of these things going off. But there were some closest shaves that they were, you know, reasonably near some of them. What with a Mars trip, when you're looking at over a year to do this, that you'll actually be flying for, whether you can avoid those or not, whether you can go at a time when they're expected to be at the minimum, you can build that in. But the risk will still be higher than the sort of usual NASA risk of level of comfort.
Well, absolutely. And as much as you can predict the coronal mass ejections and get better at monitoring space weather, which we are doing, there's always a risk. Mm. It's not like they don't happen for a year. Mm. There are plans, though, aren't there, for spaceships that have rescue modules inside them, where if there is a coronal mass ejection or a big space weather event, they could just sort of hide in the middle somewhere. This stuff isn't in any way proven.
No, because you get this horrible thing called secondary radiation, where the radiation comes in, it hits the hull of your spacecraft, and then it kicks off a load of radiation by hitting what it hits in the material. that then gives you a second wave of radiation, which then goes and irradiates you. And so you need to have something very well shielded inside.
Sounds like so much fun. Would you go?
No.
No? You wouldn't?
No.
Not at all?
No.
I thought you'd say yes.
Because it's going to be, I wouldn't go to, it's going to be really boring. It's going to be really, really boring and really, really cramped. And if I want that, I can sit in a flat in Brixton. You know, if you want to have a confined experience with boring views, it's easy to do that down here.
Without the radiation.
You know, the Tito trip, you're going to see Mars for hours in any kind of detail. It will be a tiny dot, and then it will, maybe while you're asleep, get enormously large and then enormously small again as you slingshot around it. And that is the highlight of a year and a half for you. It will be too dull.
I think the sense of romance has disappeared from your head. Let's go back now to slightly more earthly pursuits. This is a story that caught a lot of attention because, well, a lot of people have back pain, I expect. This is the idea that actually a good proportion of people, the back pain can be explained by a bacterial infection and therefore is accessible to antibiotics. It's quite a promising discovery.
Yeah, that's right. And it's quite an extraordinary one as well, because it goes against a lot of the previous thinking. And what they've really done is shown that a lot of chronic back pain, the kind of pain that lasts sort of 6 months and is there day and night, can be caused by bacteria getting into the discs inside your spine, and that you can treat that by giving people long courses of antibiotics. I spoke to Hannah Albert, who was the scientist behind all of this at the University of Southern Denmark, and I started by asking her what modic back pain was, which is the type of back pain that this works for. Give me a feel for the sorts of symptoms these people experience. How would someone know if they fall into this category?
Well, they have very clear clinical symptoms and a very clear pain history. First of all, most of them have pain more or less all the time. It varies through the day. It's worse in the morning. It's best at midday, bad in the evening. And 70% of them wake up at night when they turn over in bed. Can you imagine a life when you wake up every night turning over in bed? These people, they don't have back pain. They suffer from back pain. It is very different from, you know, now it's spring and we all go out and we dig in the garden and we do silly things and we lift too heavy things. Then we get back pain and then we do some exercises and then in a week or two it's over. And that's what you call recurrent back pain. And that happens to 80% of the population. But these people have a different pain. And one of the things that is very clear and also separates these people from what we call normal recurrent back pain is that they have more pain when they do exercise. That is a very clear symptom, because the motor changes that they have in their bone is micro fractures in the bone, and they also have ingrowth of raw nerve fiber and an infection in their disc. And that's terrible, because all the guidelines today say that if you have chronic low back pain, you have to do exercises, and if it doesn't work, you have to do more exercises. These people become worse.
How many people are we talking about potentially that might have this, say, in a country the size of the UK?
6% of the population.
Sorry, is that 6% of those with back pain?
No. 6% of the general population. And this is, there have been done huge studies in Denmark, in Finland, and lately a study of 2,500 people in China. And it's the same 6% all over.
Why wasn't this found before?
Because it's very expensive to do MRIs. You know, it's rarely done. It's not something that you go down to your doctor and say, I have a bit of back pain, and then you get an MRI. So the MRI is a key diagnostic tool that we have. And now lately, over the last couple of years, we found out these other pain history things. And also, when you do a physical examination of these people, there's also some clear clinical signs of having injuries, which are different from like having a slipped disc or normal back pain.
How did you show over these years that bugs were to blame or had a role in this?
Actually, it was some of your countrymen who found that. It was Dr. Sterling and Professor Lambert from Aston University in Birmingham. In 2001, they published a paper in Lancet who showed that when people have a slipped disc and you take out the part of the disc that is annoying the nerve down to the leg, that 53% of them were infected with some very special bugs called Proboniformes acnes. And they were ridiculed, you know, because normally you're not supposed to have bugs in your body, and especially not in your lumbar spine.
This is the microorganism that causes acne, right?
Yes, it is. It is. It's a bacteria, is what you call anaerobic, which means that it hates oxygen and it doesn't thrive when there's oxygen. And you find it two places in your body, deep in the hair follicles, where there's no oxygen, and the other places in your mouth, not in the middle of the mouth where you breathe, because that's a lot of oxygen, but outside in your cheeks on the outside and the outside part of your gums. And when you brush your teeth, it happens to all of us. Every day when we brush our teeth, and we do that as a minimum twice, we make little tiny, tiny holes in our mucosa membrane. And if you take a blood sample 5 minutes after you brush your teeth, you have a bacteria from your mouth in your blood. But we all are infected in our blood at least twice a day. And these bacteria, prion acne, which is very frequent in our mouth, they come to the disc, now to hole, because this person has a slipped disc, and they enter the disc. And the disc is a seldom organism, you can call it, because it doesn't have any blood vessels in it. It's completely white. And therefore, it is an anaerobic environment. And this is where prion acne loves to live. So it goes into the disc, heals up, and then now we have a disc with bacteria in it.
Hannah, you showed that you can treat this with long-term courses of antibiotics. I don't really know what treat means in this context, but can you take us through that?
When you give treatment, we give it for 100 days, and that seems as a very long time. But it's due to the fact that you don't have any blood vessels in the disc. As we talked about before, it's completely white, it's anaerobic. So therefore, it takes a long time for the antibiotics to spread. And when you talk about the results of this treatment, these people have first have what you call degeneration, and then they have had a slipped disc. And what you do is that you do exercises, you go to Pilates, you do all these things, and then you can keep your back pain under control. Then they get the motor changes, and then they have this relentless, endless pain who doesn't, you know, go away for anything, because fractures don't go and come, you know, they're there all the time. And what we do is, and when we give them treatment, we take this relentless pain away. They say to me, Hannah, I have gotten my life back. Yes, I still have the old back pain I had 3 years ago or 4 years ago, but I can live with that. I take it to the gym and it's gone. So we take the terrible pain away, but we cannot cure and give them new discs, but we can take the motor changes away, and that's what gives them the worst pain.
So does some of that damage that's been done to their vertebrae by these bacteria in the neighbouring disc releasing propionic acid and kind of dissolving it, does some of that damage heal in the bone?
Yes. Yes. The damage heals completely.
Right.
So if you see the vertebra afterwards, the treatment is completely normal bone, and you don't get osteoporosis or any other bad things.
This is radical, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tremendous. It's, you know, I've fought for this for 12 years, and I am just so happy, you know, that this has come out this way. And what is the best thing is that the patients are so happy. You should see my house at Christmas. The numbers of Christmas cards I've got over the years, it's just so wonderful.
What response have you had from the back pain management community, which is a dreadful phrase, but I mean people like spinal surgeons who, you know, surgeons can be fairly protective and feel that they probably have the right answers already themselves. What sort of response have you had from the community?
Well, I think that the response has changed. In the beginning, they thought that I was a loony bean. And,
Say that again. In the beginning, they thought...
That I was a loony bean? Do you call that in English? You know, they thought I was crazy.
I know what you mean.
And I was ridiculed and, you know, made fun of and so forth. But then the studies that I made, produce some, you can't say this is not true, because I've done it the most rigorous way that it is possible. So what I've found now is that they have been convinced, okay, this is a good treatment. And surgeons also want to do the very best for their patients. So actually, I have been very happily, maybe not surprised, but I've been very happy of the very positive response that I've received from the surgeons, because they don't want to do surgery in vain. They want to give surgery to these people that surgery helps. So they have decided, okay, if we are in doubt and if they look this special way, let's give them a course of antibiotics. And maybe if it doesn't work, then we can do surgery afterwards. So it's been very positive this time around.
One spinal surgeon I spoke to in London, who has dealt with some very high profile sportsmen over here, suggested that this was worth the Nobel Prize.
Yes, I am deeply honored. And I didn't start out to get the Nobel Prize. I started out to help people. But if I get it, that will be the greatest honor in my life.
Thanks to Dr. Hannah Albert there. Now, 6% of the population are affected by this particular type of back pain. So we're sure that there's going to be huge interest out there. But Hannah was very keen that there's wider understanding of who actually suffers. So she recommends that people take a simple online test to see if they are affected. Go to mastmedical.com, that's mastmedical.com, or you can find a link on our blog. That's all for this week. For breaking science news in text, video and audio, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. But from Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps and from me, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you all next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.